It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. This week, it's pure vicarious thrills. What Tuscany is to Italy, Provence is to France. And no one knows it better than American expat and French food expert Patricia Wells. She talks living and eating in the south of France. The Sterns heighten their hot dog awareness in Portland, Oregon, at the appropriately named Fido's. Wine maverick Josh Wesson talks what to drink with your omega-3s, those oily fishes of summer. I'm going to take you to one of Seattle's most elusive gems, the Lusty Luncheonette Salumi, and then nude picnics. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Today, it's summer in Provence. French food expert Patricia Wells divides her life between Paris and her farm in Provence. Her latest book is The Provence Cookbook. She's going to talk markets, restaurants, and how to be a lunatic. Our master of the bargain bottle, Josh Wesson, talks summer fishes and the wines that love them. I've tracked down one of the country's great lunch spots. It's in Seattle, and it's a little retirement project of Chef Mario Batali's dad. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's hit the road with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the road food column in Gourmet Magazine. Jane, Michael, I have a feeling that Portland, Oregon may be more food crazy than New York City. We are always deluged with calls from these people. Have you gotten out there to eat recently?
Yes, we were there about a month ago, and it really is New York, Paris, Rome, Hong Kong, and Portland. I mean, it is truly becoming one of the great food centers of the world.
And it wasn't until recently that we realized what a high hot dog awareness there is in Portland. You know, I'm very conscious of hot dogs myself.
Oh, we never noticed.
Oh, boy. All right, Michael.
Here we go again. Yep. Now, recently we were talking to you about Otto's Sausage Kitchen, which is a wonderful place in Portland. Well, here's another one that we found right downtown on the corner of Southwest Taylor Street and Park Avenue. It's a restaurant, and that's stretching the term, a place called Fido's.
You've got to be kidding. Fido's for hot dogs, right?
Fido's is a dog wagon. Yes, indeed. And a really, really excellent one. I mean, nothing deluxe or fancy, but a tidy, pretty little trailer with an awning in case it's raining, as it does sometimes rain in Portland, with not just really good all beef hot dogs, but German Frankfurters, garlicky kielbasas, andouille sausage, red hot Louisiana sausages. And what's great is the way they're cooked. They're steamed first, but then they're grilled, so they get a really good crustiness about them.
Oh, and you know what else I love on it is you can ask for Tillamook cheddar cheese to be melted on the hot dog.
Oh, that's the cheese that's up the coast, right?
Yes, yeah, that's the, yeah. That is
it's the from
regional.
The Oregon coast, and these are put inside a really good potato roll. And then once it's presented to you like that, I mean, a beautiful presentation, you turn around and there is a table with approximately 50 different condiments on it. Every kind of mustard you ever imagined, ketchup, relish, pickles, celery salt, peppers of all kinds, so you can dress it any way you want. I believe there are a couple of stools and a counter where you can sit, but most people just kind of stand around in the sunshine or under the awning if it's raining and enjoy their hot dog al fresco.
Well, you know, Portland, because of its temperature that kind of stays the same year-round, is such a wonderful outdoor eating city. And you don't have to eat seafood to really eat well in Portland. In fact, Michael, you know, I think you need a nickname. I'm going to call you Tube Steak for now.
Tube Steak? Tube Steak.
Well, at least you're not calling me a weenie.
So that's true.
I just wonder, though, is there a sommelier at Fido's so that you can have a Willamette Valley Pinot Noir? That seems like it's the only thing that's missing at this place.
I'm not actually sure it is missing. The people that run this place, David Richland and Mary Williams, are, how can I put this? I mean, they have a higher sense of what food is about than you would expect from somebody who runs a hot dog cart. The place itself reveals that. I mean, it's a really adorable, especially adorable place. And it wouldn't surprise me to find out that they, in fact, had a cooler somewhere in back of this place with some fine Oregon wines in it, too.
I think that's true in general in Portland that, I mean, maybe they should have a model. The food is better than you think it's going to be. Because, I mean, everything we ate in Portland was just kind of, you know, 15 degrees better than you'd think.
I think it's something in the water. Hey, guys, thank you.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
The Stearns are authors of Road Food. They join us every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Now, while Jane and Michael were in Oregon, we were just up the coast in Seattle. We went out to do an event with station KUOW's listeners and Chef Tom Douglas. Essentially, we all partied at Tom's restaurant, the Palace Kitchen. But Seattle is just like Portland. Three meals a day are simply not enough. So here's a few of the highlights of things we liked. In the Pike Place Market, skip the pricey places. For fresh fish, just pull up a stool at the Market Grill. For dynamite Asian fusion, go to the new Baguette Box. Ask for the Drunken Chicken Baguette. And for Brave Souls, try the pork tongue. It's really good. Café Bezelou does impeccable French pastries and croissants to die for. And for the ultimate blowout meal, Rovers. French chef Thierry Routereau paces you through small tastes of glorious food. When we couldn't take another bite, he dangled the irresistible slow-roasted pork belly. So I did what any red-blooded, overstuffed food lover would do. I had it for dessert. Now, you're going to be hearing more about Seattle later in the show, but to get a list of our picks, go to the website, splendidtable.org. Josh Wesson is my kind of guy. He's a maverick. He's a wine sommelier turned bargain hunter. Josh went from convincing his customers that $200 a bottle was a mere pittance to hunting down wines for around 10 bucks a bottle. He's the co-creator of Bestsellers Wine Shops and one of our regulars. Josh, good to have you back.
Good to be here.
Josh, my challenge for you today is oily fish. And I think this is a great time of year for all those fish that are rich and whatever, but what do you drink with oily fish?
Yeah, I love oily fish, and I'm eating as much oily fish as I possibly can, because I just read a study that the reason why Swedish men are so incredibly happy and why they live longer than just about everybody else is because they eat greasy fish. They live for it. It's their oxygen of sorts. And
I'm so glad to know you're so scientifically minded.
You know, it's I can't help myself. But I love mackerel. I love salmon, of course. Who doesn't? I even like sardines and anchovies. So I'm a little out there. But there are all sorts of fish that have fish oil that need to be attended to when it comes to wine. And one of the best things that you can put next to these fish is a wine that's got a lot of acid, because it's just like squeezing lemon on a piece of oily fish. The acid in the wine cuts through the oil and makes the fish taste more delicious.
I would imagine, though, it would have to be a wine with a lot of character, because, I mean, these fish have a lot of flavor, and they're not delicate in the classic sense.
Yeah, I mean, when you're eating herring or chubs, pogies, sardines, smelts, you're not dealing with the shy, retiring fins here. And you've got to find wines that not only have high acid, but have some depth of flavor. And there are a number of places where you can find wines that are not only lip-smacking, but can stand up to the vicious assault of a pogie or a chub and smack it right back down on the plate.
So where should we begin?
Well, a good place to look for high-acid wines with character is Austria. It's a newly hot region, even though it's part of the old world. Hot in the sense of people clamoring after these wines, because there aren't a lot of Austrian wines out there. But it's a cool climate, so the grapes that grow there never ripen so much that they lose their acidity. And the most widely planted white grape in Austria is called Grüner Veltliner. And there's a producer named Hirsch, who makes an astounding one. It's just mouth-watering. It's like biting into a Granny Smith apple, but the apple has depth of flavor beyond any apple you've ever had before. It's really a unique kind of white wine, and it's one of those white wines that if you were shipwrecked on a desert island and all you had was herring there, it's the bottle you'd want to float up.
How much does it run in price?
It's $15, which is not a lot of money. Austrian white wines are a little bit more than, let's say, their German counterparts, but I think they're worth it. And almost any Austrian white wine is going to work just fine. But Grüner Veltliners in particular really have the authority and the manner to handle the oil in these fish that we've talked about.
Is there anything in France?
Sure. If you go up north towards Paris and you're in the middle of the Loire Valley, you can find a raft of wonderful high-acid wines that have character, like Sancerre that everyone knows about, and Pouilly Fumé. But there's a sort of off-the-radar Sauvignon Blanc-producing village called Quincy, like Quincy. But its wines are less expensive and in every way as delicious as Sancerre's and Pouilly Fumé's. And in some cases, there's an element of minerality that cuts through the taste of Quincy's, which make them even more delicious with the kinds of fish that we're talking about. And they're not very expensive. You can find them for $14, $15, $16. One I like a lot that is fairly widely available is from a gentleman named Philippe Portier. And his wine goes for about $16 or $17, but worth seeking out.
Mm-hmm. Any real bargains out there? Something, you know, closer to 10?
New Zealand is known, of course, for producing a lot of white wine, and it's a cool climate, so the wines have lots of acid, and they're probably most famous for Sauvignon Blanc. But I like Rieslings from New Zealand. They're my new hot, cool grape. And I found one the other day from Giessen, a producer that I didn't know very much about. And it was all of $12 a bottle. And it's a dry wine. It's not like a lot of German Rieslings that have a kiss of sweetness. But it's lighthearted and has a lot of flavor, a lot of character, very pear-like aroma and pear-like flavors in the wine, but it's dry and it's just great. I had it with some grilled salmon, in fact, that had been served with some Brussels sprouts and bacon bits. And this wine brought everything together. It was a really delicious match.
Mm, sounds great. Hey, Josh, thank you.
Thank you.
Joshua Wesson is co-creator of Bestsellers Wine Shops. Now, you can find his wine picks on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're checking out the site, do sign up for our weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. It's brought to you by the farmers of Organic Valley. Every week, you get a new recipe for a fast supper dish. This week, it's a great French vegetarian sandwich. And you get technique and shopping tips. But best of all, it's free. So sign up at that place where all of life's problems are solved, splendidtable.org. Coming up, Feasting in Provence with Patricia Wells and a mom-and-pop salami factory in Seattle. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, a grocery store and Target all in one, where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Online at Target.com/SuperTarget. So, I have this book bristling with post-its. They say things like, do this, try for Saturday night, read, exclamation point. The book is by one of my favorite food people, Patricia Wells. It's her Provence cookbook. Now, Patricia's been working in France over 25 years, critiquing restaurants, writing about food, and teaching classes in her two favorite places, Paris and on her farm in Provence, Chantedouc. Patricia, it's good to see you again.
Lynn, thank you very much. It's great to be back.
You know, the book reads like a love letter to the south of France. And why do I get the feeling you could spend your entire life on that farm?
Oh, I could. I could. In fact, sometimes we say, let's just lock the gate and live off the land.
And that's it. I mean, you write about things that only an insider is going to pick up on. And one of the things I'm thinking about is you becoming a lunatic.
Right.
Could you explain that?
Well, you know, in Provence especially, well, all throughout France, but especially in Provence, everything happens by the moon. And, you know, there's certain days that you're supposed to plant or you're not
right.
plant. You plant things that grow on, that, you know, you plant root vegetables on a certain moon and you plant, other vegetables on this, on another moon. We bought some fabric. Pierre Frey, which is a very well-known fabric maker, we bought some fabric to cover our lawn chairs,
mm-hmm.
pool chairs. And the fabric was sunproof, waterproof, and moonproof. And in fact, in Provence, they also tell you that you should always close your shutters during the full moon because it'll ruin your furniture.
Does it really do that?
Well, the moon is awfully bright. In fact, sometimes you can wake up in the middle of the night and you think, oh, I forgot to turn the lights off.
Mm-hmm. Walk us through a market, right? What it's like right now.
Well, our village in Provence is a old Roman village, and so the markets have been there since, you know, for 2,000 years in that same place. And the market streets are exact same streets they were years ago. And you'll see all your favorite merchants will be in the same place. I always joke that you can get everything from pantyhose to tractors at the market. It is full of everything. I mean, fruits and vegetables and sewing material. You can buy your sewing machine. You can get your sewing machine repaired. You can buy tractors. You can buy even, like, awnings. But, of course, I go mostly for the fruits and vegetables.
So what's in season now?
What's in season now? Well, we've just gotten the coco blanc, which are equivalent to the red beans in Italy,
the Borlotti beans,
Borlotti
or
beans,
cranberry
yes, excuse
beans.
Me. Yes, yes. We have both the white and the red beans, the coco blanc and the coco rouge, mm-hmm. for pea stew.
Which is the soup.
The soup, the vegetable soup. And I use them all the time. In fact, the first day that they come in, I scream and holler because I get so excited because I don't like using dried beans when I can use fresh. Artichokes, the asparagus are just finishing. There will be a whole new crop of strawberries and fraise de bois, the wild strawberries. And we have another variety that comes in right now called Mara de Bois, and they're a cross between the fraise de bois and the regular strawberries. They're incredible. I mean, for about 3 months, we just get different varieties of strawberries coming through all the time.
Is there a dish in Provence that is sort of the celebration dish of summer?
I think usually it is soup au pistou. Is the vegetable soup, which is equivalent, similar to a minestrone soup, but with less pasta in it,
mm-hmm.
and obviously with the pesto sauce. I think that's the number one. When you have festivals, you'll see that a lot. Or the aioli. The aioli is also, which is the garlic mayonnaise served with steamed salt cod and a whole variety of vegetables and often snails as well.
Those, as I remember, that is this huge presentation of vegetables
exactly.
and fish, and
right.
everybody sits down at long tables,
right.
and it's
right.
the party to end
right.
all parties.
I mean, you'll drive through villages and you'll see big signs for aioli géante, for giant aioli party.
A giant, that's
géante.
What it means.
Right.
Let's say we've got airfare to Nice, okay, because you do restaurant criticism.
Right.
One or two places you would have us eat in Provence?
Oh, gosh, there's so many. Well, my favorite, which is in the book, is the Bistro de Paradou, which is in the Paradou. It's right near Les Baux.
Mm-hmm. So and, south and a little west.
Yeah. yeah. And it is, oh, it's just, it's the old mom-and-pop kind of place. It is bustling all the time. You have to reserve. In fact, when we go, you watch them turn away dozens and dozens of people who don't know they have to reserve. And it's table d'hôte, which means everybody eats the same thing. And Monday it's one specialty, and Tuesday it's another. And Mireille, the wife, is the cook, mm-hmm. and Jean-Louis is there as the barman and serving and acting as the tumbler.
And does she have a specialty that she loves to do?
Oh, so many. I have a lot of recipes of hers. One of my favorites is she does a rabbit with garlic. She does a potato puree with olive oil. She always does wonderful things with eggplant and tomatoes. That village is where I buy my favorite olive oil from Moisson-les-Alpilles, which is made with 5 varieties of olives. And I call it the Chateauneuf du Pape of olive oils.
Mm.
Oh, figs are just coming in, too. Oh, we have in our neighborhood the world's leading fig expert. He has a nursery with more than 300 varieties of figs. And last summer, he invited my students and myself to do a fig tasting of 40 varieties of figs. And so this spring, I made a list of the ones that I love the most, and I planted 8 new fig trees. And when I get back, we should have them, which I'll send to you. But my husband, when he saw all these trees, he said, "What on earth are you going to do with all these figs? I'll figure something out."
Oh, Pat, so seductive. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
French Food Authority Patricia Wells divides her life between Paris and her farm in Provence. And yes, we are jealous. Very jealous. Her latest book is The Provence Cookbook. Now, you can get her recipe for fresh white beans with garlic and light basil sauce on the website, splendidtable.org. Armandino Batali has accomplished many things in his life. He's father to a trio of talented children, including Chef Mario Batali. He was a Boeing quality control expert. He's lived abroad, and now in his retirement, when most people would be playing golf, Armandino is making some of the best salami and prosciutto in the country. His Seattle lunch place, called Salumi, has customers lined up around the block every day. It is minuscule. There's a communal table, a two-top, a stove, and a deli counter, all in a space the size of a large hallway. And even at this size, the current space is bigger than what he was working with. He used to make his salami in a little closet. But now you head through the back door, and you'll find his spanking new addition, a state-of-the-art curing room. Armandino Batali is tall, gray-haired, wrapped in an apron, and smiling like a man who's having the time of his life. How did you get into this? Tell me what this is about.
Oh boy, it's a long story. This area here, when we decided to do this, my grandfather had an Italian import store in 1903, Kitty Corner from here, called Merlino's Metropolitan Grocery. And it was there for 60 years, essentially, and my mother worked there, and my mother met my dad there. And so we were brought up in the food admiration business. And then we went to Europe. I had the opportunity to go to Europe for a couple of years, and we ended
now,
up...
Now, you ended up with Boeing, right? Am I right? I mean, you didn't work in food originally.
No. And in 1975 or 6, they asked us to go to Europe for 2 years. So we put all our things in storage, and the kids, Mario and Dana and Gina. So the assignment was wonderful, and we stayed for 20. So the kids were all brought up in Madrid from junior high through high school.
Uh-huh.
It was the best disciplined thing in their lives. They couldn't drive because of the driver's license over there. They could drink beer or wine, and we never had a problem with that. They took the taxi or a cab to go out on dates. It was just wonderful for the American family.
But what you're doing what? Salami, prosciutto, mm-hmm. pork shoulder, which is mm-hmm. called copa. This stuff is not something you do by the seat of your pants. I mean, you can end up with something pretty god-awful if you don't know what you're doing. So did you train for this?
Well, when we were in Spain, we worked with a couple butchers 3 or 4 times in Alicante.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to the farm, and these were friends of ours. It was really an honor for us to even be invited. So I really got intensely excited about it mm-hmm. at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, come with me. We'll go back and see our little edifice in
okay.
the back.
I really want to see this. We're in this very modern area now here at the back of the shop. And everything looks brand new. It's immaculate. The walls look like they're metal. And then you look through these big glass windows, and hanging on racks are all these salami and hams. And what I'm wondering is, has there been a change in how those things taste going from working in that little closet to working in a different environment?
No. If anything, they'll be better back here. I think one of the great things, number one, is not only the spices or what it goes, it's the feeling that you can touch the animal, so to speak, and touch the salami and realize what's happening to it as it goes through its curing cycle. I went to a class at Iowa State. This is a good example.
Mm-hmm.
the doctor that taught the class, he says, how many little salami, mom and pop salami factories do we have here? And I raised my hand. And another guy from California raised his hand. And the rest were 60 people from big companies. And he says, how do you know when a salami is done? And I said, well, in our place, we touch it and feel it, and we have this innate logic of watching that product because we're small. And so he said to the other guy the same, and he said, I have this 80-year-old guy that does this in our company. I said, I guess I'm the 80-year-old guy. And the doctor, he says, don't you ever lose that person. You know. So.
But I want to get in your head. Could you take me?
Oh, I'd love to.
Can I touch the salami?
Yeah, you can touch it.
Okay. This, it, you know how people talk about opening a bottle of wine and getting an aroma? When you walk in here, you get this rush of sweet meat is the best way to describe it, and spices, and you know what's strange? I'm looking at what's here, and it's almost as though I'm seeing a map of heritage. Could you explain what is here, and why did you decide to make mm-hmm. these things?
We have, like, what you're looking at here is about 10 or 11 different salamis. We have hot sopressata, which is very traditionally southern Italy, Naples, Calabria, in that area, spicy with paprika and cayenne. But the one below it there is a smoked paprika, and that's taken a little bit of Spain with the smoked paprika and marrying it to the Italian concept of curing, and it comes out, a little taste really sells that product.
Mm-hmm.
Next to that, there's some oregano.
Oh, yeah.
Next to that is the mole salami that was made this week. But mole was developed simply because I wanted to do something for the Spanish community, and I think there's a lack of creativeness in the salami business. So we're trying to develop that a little bit further. And it's a little bit off the wall, but people love it.
So what's in it?
Mole has guitar chocolate cocoa. It has a lot of it, like 3 pounds per 100 pounds. It's got ancho chilies, chipotle peppers, garlic, and of course the sugars and the lactic acid to create the fermentation process.
Is there a big difference between how people cure in Italy and what the USDA has you do here?
The big difference is tracking the process mm-hmm. from the beginning to the end here. As far as a difference, no, not a big difference. We probably do. We control our processes much more, the temperature and the ambiente,
mm-hmm.
than over there. And what I like about over there is that each piece is an individual work of art.
I don't think
they could reproduce it. And why would they?
Well, now I understand where Mario gets his deep feeling for food. Armandino, thank you. This has been an honor.
You got to taste one of these. Please, please do. These are some of the products we made, and it would be an honor to have you taste them.
All right, now tell me what we've got here. We've got... Okay, this is the...
Armandino Batali's restaurant in Seattle is Salumi. Now, I have to tell you, by 11 a.m., the line was out the door. By noon, it was around the block. But I've never seen such a happy crew. I mean, samples are given out, everybody schmoozes. Armandino also offers an Adopt a Prosciutto program for those of you who are aspiring salumi makers. Well, for information, go to the website, splendidtable.org. The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. And we've got John on the line. Hey, John, what do you want to talk about?
Lynn, I want to talk about ox tongue with you.
Have you met up with an ox recently?
No. Well, in a roundabout way, yes. I was at the wonderful St. Paul Farmers Market a few weeks ago.
Uh-huh.
And a meat producer gave me an ox tongue for free. I've got a good relationship with him, and he just gave me this tongue. He said nobody ever buys it. And so I hunted up a recipe for corned ox tongue.
And oh,
I ended
great.
Up brining it for about 2 weeks. And,
uh-huh.
And it was absolutely delicious. But my wife won't even be in the kitchen she wouldn't even come in the kitchen when I had it out. And so I'm looking for maybe another way to prepare it.
I have to tell you, there's some things you can do with ox tongue. Just don't tell people it's tongue.
Sure.
Okay. The basic way, now you can do what you did, which is brine it and cure it. But mm-hmm. The other way to do it, which takes less time, you can eat in less than 2 weeks. Let me put it this way.
Yeah, it was quite a wait.
Is the idea that you poach the tongue. Now, okay. You can poach it in broth. You can put any kind of spices you want in it. I mean, if you were in Germany, you would have pickling spices in it.
Sure.
You know, the bay leaf and the allspice and bits of ginger and a little hot chili and clove and black peppercorns. But the idea is that you cook the tongue about 40 to 50 minutes a pound.
Okay.
Or until it's tender. And then you cool it down a little bit in that broth.
Uh-huh.
You pull it out, and what you have to do is lightly skin it. And
yeah.
when you flip it over, the place where it would connect to the animal has some bones and a bit of cartilage, and you remove that.
Right.
Now your tongue is cooked, and almost every recipe for tongue begins with this kind of thing. Then you can do Mexican tongue by cutting it about a quarter inch thick, searing it in a skillet, pulling it out of the skillet and making a sauce with fresh chili and coriander and cumin and a bit of tomato. Then you spoon that over the tongue. Now you're in Mexico. If you want to, you can do a dish that I had for the first time. I think I was 18 years old in a German restaurant, and I've never forgotten it. The tongue was cooked as I've described, okay?
Uh-huh.
And what they did was they made a sweet-sour dressing. Sugar, vinegar, garlic.
They like a sauerbraten dressing.
Right? Yeah, exactly, okay. Exactly. With a ton of shaved red onion. You know, paper-thin shaved red onion. And the idea was that you, in some of that dressing, you marinated paper-thin slices of the tongue. And then in a separate bowl, you marinated those onions. And you shredded up some green lettuce, very simple lettuce, piled it on a plate. You piled on, or you laid out the tongue, and then you covered it with this mess of limp but fabulous shaved onion and and it's called Ochsenmalsalat, and it's a sweet sour salad. And I can remember eating that, and then was only afterward that I was told, you know, at 18 I'd eaten tongue, and I decided I'd been poisoned. But
I think that is the trick, is to
don't tell them.
Give it away.
They're gonna love it.
It is delicious.
That's right.
Just rich
and really rich.
It tastes like a really good like a pulled short rib.
That's right. And the other thing is, you know, it's one of the great secrets to a great broth in the Emilia-Romagna region of Italy. When you do a big quantity, like a whole chicken, and you have veal, you throw in a small beef tongue or a veal tongue. And then you eat it with great balsamic vinegar.
Awesome. I can't wait.
You are going to have a ball.
Yeah, I think
just
so.
Never tell them what they're eating. Thanks, John.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. 800-537-5252. You can get us that way. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. In honor of wild salmon season, here's the question. Which kind of salmon is presently vying for the title most expensive? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we'll be taking more of your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can find them online at target.com/SuperTarget. Now, we're going to be taking more of your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. The question was, in honor of the wild salmon season, which kind of salmon is presently vying for the title most expensive? It's white king salmon. $20 a pound is a bargain price. This is the rarest of salmon. Only the king salmon can be white, and only 6 to 8% of them turn out this way. And to make it even tougher for fishermen, you can't tell if the flesh is white until you cut into the fish. Now, scientists speculate that the white salmon has some kind of enzyme deficiency, which prevents it from taking up the color that the salmon normally gets from the shrimp that they eat. Now, this rare baby used to end up in the cat food pile, but now it's chic eats. White, also known as ivory salmon, tastes sweet and is especially fine when you slow roast it with a little good-tasting butter. Okay, let's get back to those phones. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's see, who has been waiting patiently? We've got Lauren on the line from St. Paul. Hey, Lauren, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Well, I had a very strange thing happen the other day. I was making a dish that I make probably once a week and probably have for the last 3 years. It's my standby, get home late, make quick meal.
Right.
And it's a pasta that has sautéed garlic and capers in olive oil and whole chili peppers sautéed with it. And then you put that over pasta with lemon juice and, you know, cheese, and you're all set to go.
Sounds great.
Well, it is, except for one day I was making it, and the garlic suddenly and pretty quickly started to turn blue. And I mean, like bright royal blue.
Oh, God.
And I looked at it and picked up the phone and called my mom. And she said, call Lynn. So here I am.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Okay. I think I know what went wrong. Or it's not even going wrong. It's, you know, life happens. It's that kind of thing.
Okay. No, but see, this is the thing. All the ingredients that I used are things that I was using the same garlic and the same capers and everything, both before and after. Well, not before, maybe after that. And the same thing never happened again.
Okay. Just off the top of your head, do you remember, by the way, if the garlic was particularly fresh, like really moist?
Oh, I don't know.
Was the pan aluminum on the inside?
Oh, I see where you're going. It was, I think it's, you know, a coated pan.
Oh, okay. Then it's not. Let me tell you what I think happened, because I've been there and done that, but I did it when I was pickling. I was pickling garlic cloves.
Uh-huh.
And before I realized I really shouldn't do that. But anyway, and I was using iodized salt.
Oh.
And they all turn purple. Great Christmas gift. I can't tell you how delightful they were. And it turned out that there are certain substances, evidently, in garlic that for no seeming consistency, like one clove on a head could do it and then the rest of them won't.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That will react with acid, perhaps. Like, for instance, if there was any acid of any kind in the pan, I mean like a bit of tomato.
Could it also have been the vinegar in the capers?
Yeah. Could have been. And then the other thing that can be happening is that garlic, raw garlic, has a sulfur compound in it. And if it comes in contact with any kind of copper, and by the way, that could be like a minute quantity in your water. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, something in the air, it will also turn it blue or purple. So iodized salt, and that's why in pickling, they'll always talk about using kosher salt or uniodized salt, because it can react with certain things.
Okay.
So any place where there's iodine, the freak thing of that clove of garlic had more of the particular substance, so it reacted with an acid.
Okay.
Or it's a minute amount of copper.
Okay.
But the good news with all of this is it may not look great, but it's not harmful.
Well, that's good, because I made my fiance eat it before I did.
And he's still with us, right?
Yes, he is.
I like that concept.
Okay. But anyway, don't worry. And you know, you can't not have it happen. Occasionally it'll happen because of the garlic.
Okay.
Yeah,
well,
so don't worry about it.
The number of times I've made this, it was pretty shocking.
I can imagine. You probably thought, you know, a genie had come into the kitchen. Hey, thanks, though.
Yes,
thanks for calling.
You
take care.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. 800-537-5252. That's how you can get to us. I would be pretty stunned by blue garlic on my pasta. But then again, think of it. It might be pretty. Call us, guys. 800-537-5252. We've got Andy calling from Portland. Andy, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Well, Lynn, last month my wife and I were vacationing in London. And we went to a little open-air market in Greenwich. Uh-huh. And there was this stand selling Italian nougat.
Ooh.
And we each bought a slice of it, and a very small slice because it was expensive, but they had all kinds of flavors. It just looked beautiful. We each bought a slice, we got on the boat, and started eating it. And as soon as we were eating it, we wished that they could turn the boat back, go back and get more. It was incredible. It was fluffy, kind of like the inside of a Mars bar, only a lot better than that.
Mm-hmm.
So as soon as I got home, I got on the internet and I looked for a recipe for this stuff and I started into it and I just had a terrible disaster.
Oh, it's tricky. Just to explain to everybody what we're talking about, it's sometimes called torroni. It comes two ways, hard and soft, both of which will stick to your teeth. And it's like, don't you think it's sort of like a really upscale example of saltwater taffy in a funny way.
Yeah,
I mean, it has that chewy quality and always has nuts in it. And it comes in chocolate and all kinds of flavors. But traditionally, it's vanilla. It's white. And it's done with egg whites. This is what it's basically. I've never actually made it, but I know what's in it. It's a sugar syrup of honey and sugar and sometimes corn syrup that's taken up to at least 250 degrees. Okay. And that is poured into fluffy beaten egg whites. You know, you get them to soft peak stage and you pour in this hot syrup and it cooks the egg whites and it also stiffens them. And then you fold in a ton of whole blanched, you know, peeled almonds that you've lightly toasted.
Right.
And you put that in a loaf pan and you let that sit. Now that ends up sometimes being very gooey, but that's pretty close. Oh, you add a little salt and vanilla to that.
The step that I had the problem with was caramelizing honey. Now I've caramelized sugar before, and I set up kind of a double boiler, and I stirred this and cooked it for hours and hours and hours, and I could not tell any change at all.
What color was your nougat?
It was white, very white.
Yeah. See, I'm wondering if you need the caramelized honey, because a lot of recipes don't have you caramelizing.
Is that something you can buy, pre-caramelized honey?
No, you can't. But I try 2 parts sugar to 1 part honey. I would boil it to 200. You have to get a candy thermometer.
Okay,
don't trust your eye on this. You want to take it up to 250 degrees. And as you get around 240 or whatever, put your heavy-duty, you need a mixer, a freestanding mixer. You want 2 egg whites to start with. And you want to get those up to soft peak. So I usually start the machine at medium speed. Because if you overbeat the egg whites, you're toast.
Okay.
And when they're fluffy and the temperature is right, you pour that in. Stand back. You don't want to get spattered. It's a bad burn. And then keep whipping at high speed until it's cooled down.
All right.
And then I would fold in almost an equal amount of the nuts.
Okay.
And see what happens. And by the way, Deenan DeLuca has great imported Italian nougat.
Well, I'm determined. I'm going to try it again.
Try it. Do try it. But also know that mail order is a glorious thing.
Okay. Thank you so much. I love the show.
Thank you, sir. Thanks for calling.
Bye.
Goodbye. 800-537-5252. I wonder, some things maybe were never meant to be conquered. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. We've got Jade calling from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Jade, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Lupini beans.
Oh, great snacks.
But not in the dry form. And that's the way I've got them. And I went to Google, you know, and looked, and we're talking about letting water run on them for 3 weeks. I thought, not really.
3 weeks?
That's what it says. is.
I don't want to see the water bill.
That's it. I think what they probably meant is put it in a mountain stream in a bag and just let it go by.
Yeah, I think those are from the days. Lupini beans are a Mediterranean bean, mm-hmm. and they're kind of golden in color. They kind of look a little bit like a misshapen lima bean, right?
Or favas.
Yeah, like a fava, right. Mm-hmm. And kind of kidney-shaped in a funny way. And
absolutely.
They can be utterly delicious, and this is the key. It used to be that they were really bitter, mm-hmm. and they had, I think it's alkaloids in them.
Yes.
And that's where that soaking and stuff came from. But now we're dealing with new strains of the beans.
Okay.
All you want to do is cook them. They're dried. So you're mm-hmm. going to, you know, pour boiling water over them in a bowl.
You don't soak them?
This is
overnight?
That's what we're going to do.
Okay.
I'm giving you the fast soak.
Oh, okay.
You pour boiling water over them in a bowl, let them sit for 2 hours, drain them, put them in a pan, cover them with water by a couple of inches, and you can throw maybe some garlic and onion in that if you want to.
Uh-huh.
Simmer them gently until they're tender, and it depends on the age of the beans. It can be 45 minutes, it could be an hour and a half.
Okay, yeah.
And once you've got them at that point, now you can do whatever you want. I mean, you can dress them with oil and vinegar and eat them, you know, as a main dish or a side dish. You can throw them in salads. One thing that they do in Italy, and you've had it as a snack, the cooked beans will be allowed to sort of dry on a screen just so they're not wet and too moist.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah.
And they're tossed with olive oil and coarse salt and roasted in a shallow pan.
Oh, yum.
And you know, until they smell good and they taste to have a little bit of crunch to them, just a little.
Sure.
And they're great snacks, and they're kind of sweet and meaty, and they're just delicious.
So the bitterness is gone now.
The bitterness is gone. It's toast.
Oh, great.
You don't need the mountain stream in the backyard. You're safe.
Okay.
You're okay.
So should they be like garbanzos when they're done?
Yeah, they should. Well, they should be a little softer than that. They should be a tender bean that's good to eat all by itself.
Okay.
That's how you'll know they're right. Not mushy, obviously.
But you don't use them in anything else. They're basically like with antipasto or something like that.
Oh, but yeah, but people put them in pasta. I mean, you can use them the way you would use any good-tasting bean. Whatever you do with a fava bean, you can do with a lupini.
Okay.
If you remember that, or whatever you do with a chickpea, you can do with a lupini.
Right, I use lots of chickpeas, yeah.
Yeah, so that's your basic rule of thumb.
Oh, super.
Hey,
that's
great.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Hey, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. 800-537-5252. That's how you can get a hold of us. You know how messy outdoor eating can get? All that barbecue sauce and drippy watermelon ruins your clothes. Well, there's a solution. Don't wear clothes. The American Association for Nude Recreation has a whole list of outdoor parties that you can attend without a stitch, and nobody will stare. It's the 29th annual Nude Recreation Week, and spokesperson Carolyn Hawkins is on the phone. Carolyn, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Carolyn, I understand from your press release, and I'm going to quote, that nude recreation is one of the fastest growing trends in both travel and recreation. I find that hard to believe. I mean, is this true?
It is absolutely true. I'll give you just a little example. About 10 years ago, we started out with a nude cruise, and that had about 500 passengers. As of right now, we are topping out Carnival's largest cruise line at about 2,200.
Wow.
And they sell out. As a matter of fact, the cruise is coming out in February, and it's already sold out. It's phenomenal.
Why do you think this is happening now?
Well, to be honest with you, we have a lot of European visitors. We are very active with the community, and we publicize. We're out in mainstream magazines. We do a lot with the community. We have over 267 clubs throughout the U.S. and Canada. And, you know, they're always, everybody's out working for the community. So word of mouth really, really spreads. And, you know, when you shed your clothes, you shed your stress, and you just have this the best way and best feeling to have the sun basking on you or swimming nude. It's great.
Do you think that this has anything to do with the obesity problem in the United States, with people trying to just accept their bodies as they are?
Absolutely. I'm older now, and I've been a nudist for about 25 years, and I was about probably 30 pounds lighter 25 years ago, and we are about
weren't
body
we all?
Absolutely. We're about body acceptance, and you know what? The best part at being at a resort, in my opinion, you uh-huh. know that person from the heart.
It's the great leveler, isn't it?
Love it.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, let's talk about the parties, because you've got a long list of the parties that are happening mm-hmm. during this week, and evidently they're open to anybody, whether you're a member of the club or not. But do you have guidelines for cooking and eating in the nude? I mean, I'm just thinking of, you know, the obvious problems.
Well, we have an apron that we sell a lot of. It says cooking in the nude. A lot of our members do use that.
Uh-huh.
Like, first of all, because it promotes the association. And number two, we are practical. I mean, we're nude when possible, but clothed when practical. And if I'm going to be assisting or cooking on a barbecue grill, I'm going to be very cautious as to what I have on.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But let me tell you, I'm a slob when it comes to eating, so if I don't have any clothes on, I don't have to worry about that watermelon dripping down my arms or my toes.
You just head for the lake when you're done, right?
Just head for the lake, absolutely, or the shower, absolutely.
Well, Carolyn, I have to ask you this question. I hope you're not insulted.
No.
Do you office in the nude?
No, unfortunately, no. We are in town. We're located in town.
Uh-huh.
We do have Cypress Cove, which is right here near our office, and that's where I live, actually. So the minute I get home, I do. My clothes come off the first thing. But, you know, after wearing pantyhose and being dressed up in an office all day, you know, that's, I can't wait to get home.
Hey, Carolyn, thank you for talking with us.
No problem.
Take care.
Thank you for having me.
Carolyn Hawkins is spokesperson for the American Association for Nude Recreation. Now, for information on their activities, go to the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week, guys. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Mark Twain. He said, part of the secret of life is to eat what you like and let the food fight it out inside. Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And be sure to take a look at our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. You can register for it right on the site. It's easy, it's fun, and best of all, it's free. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical directors this week were Nick Kariakis and Scott Liebers. Our website is managed by Julia Schrankler and Judy Graham. This week we want to welcome the newest addition to the Splendid Table crew, Eric Lubke. Now, by all accounts, he is a very lusty eater. Definitely a welcome addition to the show. Have a great week. Join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Kessler.
American Public Media.